For the week of July 17th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 112, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Hogwarts, I'm Michael Giltz.
Is Hogwarts a... I guess it is a place, isn't it?
Of course it's a place.
That's right.
Well, I saw a girl walking down the street who said, I was waitlisted at Hogwarts.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, I don't know. Do they waitlist all over the world? I guess they do.
I guess so.
Yeah, I guess it's when you apply to college early and they say, yes, we'll accept you.
Waitlisting is you're waiting, you're on the list waiting, hope to get accepted. You say, I want to be on you. You didn't make the cut, but you're hoping somebody will drop out and you can get in. Early admissions is what you're referring to, I guess.
Yes, indeed. I never had to worry about waitlisting since I got into every school I applied to.
Did you get into Harry Potter this weekend?
I did not get into Harry Potter. I haven't been into Harry Potter in years. In fact, I don't think I've seen the fifth, sixth, or the seventh film, the first film. So why see the second of the seventh film?
You're getting confusing. Tell us what other news we're going to cover this week.
Well, okay. Well, since last week we stumbled our way through trying to explain all that internet service provider common framework for copyright alerts, all those alerts that internet service providers will be sending out to all of you pirates. Since we stumbled our way through that last week, on today's show we will be talking to Abigail Phillips from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or as those in the know call it, the EFF. And she is actually an expert on the subject. The Emmy nominations were handed out last week, which means we won't have to read any more stories on who might get nominated.
We'll just read stories about why people didn't get nominated.
Exactly. I was just about to say that. And by the way, Michael, I don't know if you know this. Apparently, the world is coming to an end because video subscription service Netflix has raised their prices.
By 60%.
Well, okay. But I thought the whole 405 and freeway in Los Angeles closing down was more of a looming disaster. Speaking of subscription services, Spotify, the popular music streaming service from Europe, finally made its way into the United States. We'll tell you what we think of it. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and wizard Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I wish. The number one movie at the box office worldwide, and there's no better example of why we always try and present worldwide box office figures when we can, is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, or as I like to refer to it, HP7P2 3D. It grossed $475 million worldwide in its opening weekend. It set all sorts of box office records. It launched into the top 100 grossing movies of all time. It is now number 98 of all time. And that's after its opening weekend. It is a monster, no matter how you slice it. At number two is Transformers Dark of the Moon, which grossed $60 million worldwide. It's at $762 million and counting. At number three is Cars 2, the Pixar film. It grossed another $20 million worldwide. It's at $312 million and counting, and looks like it's still going to be the weakest Pixar film of them all. At number four, Horrible Bosses, the R-rated comedy, which grossed $17.6 million. It's basically open in the U.S. only. It has grossed $60 million so far. At number five, Zookeeper, the Kevin James comedy, another $17.4 million. It's at $58 million worldwide. At number six, another R-rated comedy, the Cameron Diaz film Bad Teacher, that grossed $11.7 million worldwide. It's at just under $150 million total. At number seven, Kung Fu Panda 2, another $10 million worldwide. It's at $582 million. At number eight, a sort of gentle, family-oriented counter-programming to Harry Potter was Winnie the Pooh, the hand-drawn Disney film, which got pretty good reviews and grossed $8 million. It opened basically in the U.S. only. At number nine, Jim Carrey's comedy, Mr. Popper's Penguins. It just edged into $100 million total worldwide, which is not a good thing to hear about when a movie is mostly done during its U.S. run. And at number 10, another R-rated comedy, Bridesmaids, $7 million worldwide. It's at $220 million and counting. And the big news, of course, is Harry Potter.
Yes. I mean, that is just a phenomenal opening gross. I don't know. I mean, surely it will be topped at some point in the future, because if you look at the biggest openings of all time, I think the first 20 are all from 2000 and on. So
they're all from this decade. I can tell you right now what movie will top it. And that is, of course, The Dark Knight Rises. The Batman franchise, since its beginning in the 80s, has always set box office records virtually with every film. I guarantee you, even if another film passes Harry Potter before that, next summer, 2012, and we saw the trailer for Dark Knight Rises in front of Harry Potter this weekend, that movie will break the opening weekend box office record.
Well, of course, HP7P23D, so this latest Harry Potter film, beat The Dark Knight, which...
That's right. It dethroned The Dark Knight. Harry Potter in North America grossed $168 million. That passed The Dark Knight, which had grossed $158 million just a few years ago.
Yeah, in 2008.
It also, I mean, to me, the crazy figure was that it grossed $43.5 million at the midnight screening.
Were you one of those people at midnight that was sitting there in the theater going, oh, I can't wait?
Well, don't make fun of them. That's what the movie industry lives on. But they grossed $43 million at midnight. That's a bigger opening than most movies have had in history. I mean, it's unbelievable. At midnight. I mean, that opening day from midnight to the following midnight was an unbelievable $92 million in one day. Again,
the highest grossing day in history.
The highest grossing day in history. The highest grossing midnight in history. The highest grossing in history in both North America and worldwide. It set every record you can think of. It will, of course, pass $1 billion before all is said and done. It will be the first Harry Potter film to do so. What amazes me, and I don't often say this, but I was wrong. I thought Harry Potter, like Transformers, would reverse the trend we've seen in the last year and a half of people rejecting 3D. But they didn't. They rejected the 3D of this movie. 43% of the money was made in 3D, which is very low. And that means 57% of the people who went to see the final Harry Potter movie actively and aggressively avoided the 3D screens. I'm kind of amazed by that.
Actually, I'm not amazed at it at all. I mean, you have seven movies, really, when you think about it, that mm-hmm. were shot in and shown in 2D. So this is a sequel that is now being done in 3D. And granted, Transformers 1 and 2 were in 2D. But you don't have purists the way you do with Harry Potter. And so I think a lot of the Harry Potter people, you know, the big fans, wanted to see Harry Potter 7P2, whatever this thing is called. They wanted to see it the same way they saw the other seven films.
Well, I think you're right. That is an emotional reason. Nonetheless, this is a family film. It's a blockbuster summer movie. It's exactly the sort of movie they make in 3D. They spent a year doing it. They took time and care to do it right. It wasn't a junky, quick 3D transfer. And people didn't want it. They're like, no, we don't want to spend the extra money. I'm still kind of amazed. They did spend a lot of money on IMAX, which boggles my mind because people, if you pay to see a movie in IMAX that's not shot in IMAX, you're wasting your money. You're getting a poor theatrical experience. But no, in IMAX, the movie grossed $15.5 million. It's a record for an opening weekend. It topped Alice in Wonderland. And I don't know why they're doing it. My brother and his family went in Pennsylvania. They said the line for IMAX was out the door. They saw it in 3D and the place was not even full.
Did you see it in 3D or did you see it in 2D?
I felt like I had to see it in 3D just to see what they did. It was fine. There were a few nice touches. I didn't feel like it was necessary. I felt like if I'd seen it in 2D, it would have been fine.
Well, you know, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, that is a mouthful. It has another dubious record that it broke, the steepest drop from a Friday to a Saturday.
Well, that's meaningless in the context of these numbers.
I was just going to say, I just wanted to see what you were going to say about that. Given that you made $150 million in your first day, what does a drop between Friday and Saturday mean, really?
Well, Friday they made $92 million.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they're counting the 43.5. They must be counting that in Friday rather than counting it on like a Thursday or a midnight showing.
Right. On Friday, they made $92.2 million. On Saturday, they made $42.85 million. So they're counting that as a 53% drop. But it's almost a separate day of screenings. We're talking about the people who go at midnight. So if you look at the actual Friday day numbers compared to Saturday, it's a very modest drop and shows that the movie is great. It also got good reviews. I thought it was quite satisfying. I was a little surprised how much I enjoyed it. It's not a great movie. None of them were. But I would say it was a 3-star movie. It had a nice grimness about it, which I think suits the series well. I think Daniel Radcliffe is the most improved. It was enjoyable. And as an accomplishment in the industry, it's unbelievable. 8 films, all of them grossing $800 to $1 billion, made so quickly with child actors who grew up while you were making the movies, making the series, starting it before you even knew how it was going to end. There were a lot of challenges in this, and it's really one of the notable film series of all time.
Yeah, that's true. They did start this with, they had no idea how it was really going to end, although did it really matter? Because each one of those stories, except toward the middle.
It does.
There.
You don't know how to foreshadow or what tone to take or what's going to go on. And you make changes and decisions about what to cut because you can't feature everything in the book. And that can you know, affect things, though they always had J.K. Rowling there to tell them, no, 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 you need to leave Dobby in, or you need to, you know, you can't cut this, or you can cut that. So they had that advice there, but it's still a remarkable accomplishment. Simply casting child actors who grew up over 10 years and still look the way they should. They can't control how they grow up, and in fact, they all still fit their roles quite well.
Right. Well, you know, you were talking about 3D here in the United States and how only 43% of the audience wanted to see Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 in 3D here in the U.S. However, overseas, 61% of the revenue came from 3D venues.
Right. That's because they're on a different cycle. Just like we had 2 years ago, 60%, 65% of grosses coming from 3D for those type of movies. Overseas, that's where they're at right now. I predict in 2 years, they will have grown tired of it, sick of paying a premium, and they won't want to do it either.
Moving on from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, I know it is really hard to do that since it's such a big film. Midnight in Paris surpassed Hannah and Her Sisters to become Woody Allen's highest grossing movie ever in North America. Although, you know, it ranks seventh among Allen's in attendance. So it probably...
Well, I don't know what ticket sales we have from the 80s, so I'm not quite sure how people know that. I also don't have any good overseas figures for Hannah and Her Sisters or the Woody Allen movies that he made in his heyday. So I'm not sure if we'll ever know what his top grossing movie is worldwide. We know that Match Point made about $87 million worldwide. This movie looks like it will pass it. But whether that actually tops what Hannah and Her Sisters grossed, I don't know.
And Transformers, first film to cross the $300 million threshold here in North America this year. Not bad.
And Harry Potter will do that in another week.
Yeah, and Harry Potter did that last night while sleeping.
That's right. The nice thing is that it's a movie that gained attention and got good reviews, which we have not had in the top 10 for a little while. Most of the movies have been pretty poorly reviewed coming out this summer. So, you know, some movies have been okay, like Horrible Bosses or Winnie the Pooh or, you know, people saying, well, this is okay, that's okay. But by and large, not a summer of well-made good movies, but there have been a lot of commercial successes. This is the first one with Harry Potter and Midnight in Paris where you have two movies that got good reviews by and large and have done very well at the box office.
Yeah, I mean, this summer is really proving that the movie critic is commoditized. Nobody really cares anymore. They've been marginalized. It's like, oh, great, Cars 2 sucks. I'll go see it.
No, Cars 2 has done very poorly, so I don't think that's fair, but that's because the word of mouth of audiences is bad. Critics have never mattered in that sense. As Roger Ebert says, where they make the difference is in a smaller film that people might not have gone to, critics can get them to go to that.
Well, from the world of movies into the world of television, and speaking of people who got lambasted by the critics, just a quick note here. There were two shows, one in the 60s, one that straddled the 60s and 70s, that got like just seared by critics, and yet they are some of the most enduring television series of all time. Do you know which series I'm talking about?
I don't agree with you, but yes, Gilligan's Island and Brady Bunch.
Yes. Sherwood Schwartz died at the age of 94. He was the creator of Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. He actually wrote the theme songs, those memorable theme songs, to both of those shows.
I could have retired on that alone.
Yeah, exactly, because they were played on the radio as well. Yes, you're right. Now, he started his career in radio writing for Bob Hope before running off and winning an Emmy in 1961 for his work on the Red Skelton Show, and he was with that show for 7 years. And kind of as an antidote to the Red Skelton Show, he decided to do a wacky comedy. That was Gilligan's Island, which only lasted 3 years, except it's lasted 30 years in reruns. And then the Brady Bunch lasted 5 years, 1969 to 1974. As I mentioned, both shows were lambasted by critics.
That's true. I don't know that the Gilligan's Island was a antidote to the Red Skelton Show. That's the comedy, so a sketch comedy show. So I don't think it's any big stretch to go from Red Skelton to Gilligan's Island.
Oh, I know. I think it was more that it was working on the show was so hard that he just wanted something light and airy. And
I see. Well, yeah, but leading your own show is not easy. But yes, he died. God bless him. He created two shows that are in the popular consciousness. More power to him. And after that Emmy he won for the Red Skelton Show in 1961, he never came within a stone's throw ever again, unlike a lot of people this week.
That's right. Do you want to go over? And now, obviously, this is besides the whole News Corp kerfuffle, which is going on, and the phone hacking.
Kerfuffle is not exactly the right word.
No.
They're testifying in front of Congress, in front of Parliament. I mean, people are being arrested and brought into questioning and put out on bail. This is a crime.
Yeah, this is a nuclear explosion. If I've ever seen one.
But amongst all that, there were the Emmy nominations.
Yeah, so we'll lead with that, I guess, this week. how do you want to start? I mean, I'm so sick of hearing about the Emmys. I've been hearing about them for 4 months.
Well, I'm not sick of them. I like the Emmy nominations and I don't read all that stuff in advance. I think the big thing is that we look at the top lists and one thing strikes me right away, and that's that the major networks are becoming increasingly out of the loop. They simply do not matter. When it comes to top dramas, top movies, top miniseries, the major networks just aren't even in play.
Well, I would agree with you. I read one story that compared it to the Grammys and said much the way indie labels have taken over the Grammys with Arcade Fire winning Best Album of the Year this year. The same is true of the Emmys, that you have all of these cable networks coming in like HBO and Showtime and AMC and you name it, and they're winning these big awards now.
And it makes sense. There's hundreds of channels creating content. So why should the four big networks dominate the proceedings? They did for many decades, but slowly but surely, cable channels are taking over. There's more of them. And quite notably, they make shows in smaller amounts. They make 12 episodes of a series, and then they wait a year and do 12 more. That's a very different challenge from making 22 or 24 episodes of a drama on CBS. Maintaining your quality over 22, 24 episodes is really, really hard. That's why you see British imports, and people say, oh my gosh, that's such a good show. Well, they made six of them, and then they took a break for 9 months. You know, when you're turning out 24 episodes of a sitcom, it's not so easy.
Yes, but you have the overhead of a broadcast network, you need 22 to 25 episodes just to keep the lights on because you need to keep viewers coming back to you week after week after week to get that advertising revenue up.
That's true. But even if you do create 20 episodes of a series, you know you can't rerun them anymore and make your money back. So what you need is 20 episodes of one show in the fall and another 20 episodes of a show in the spring, a different series. And then you need another series, maybe a reality show in the summer, that's cheap enough to produce and air during the summer. And that's just for 1 hour of programming.
Right, because you don't have these Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Islands where they're syndicated for 30, 40 years.
That's right. So when you look at the outstanding drama series nominees, you see Boardwalk Empire from HBO, Dexter from Showtime, Friday Night Lights from DirecTV, though the reruns were shown on NBC, Game of Thrones from HBO, The Good Wife on CBS, and Mad Men on AMC. And you're looking at five out of the six shows were not originating on broadcast. Five out of the six shows were not long-running 20-episode series. Only The Good Wife, you know, fits that standard formula. And it's no surprise.
But when it comes to sitcoms, you really definitely see the networks take over.
I would say more that their reign has not ended yet.
Okay.
The outstanding comedy series were The Big Bang Theory, finally nominated, Glee, which is not a comedy, Modern Family, The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 30 Rock. But when you look at all the shows that people talked about and say, why wasn't this nominated? Why wasn't that nominated? You're looking at a lot of cable shows that I think are going to slowly work their way onto that list as well. That's sort of the last holdout. That's the final stand for the networks, the sitcom category. When you look at, you know, miniseries, the networks just don't even come into play. But, you know, all these things raise questions. Is Glee a comedy? You know, this has often happened with the Emmys. Northern Exposure, Ally McBeal, all were nominated as comedies when essentially they were dramas. They had humor in them, but they're not comedies.
But they don't really have a good category for them because they're kind of like musicals.
Is Downton Abbey a miniseries? Under the miniseries category, we have Cinema Verite, Downton Abbey, The Kennedys, Mildred Pierce on HBO, which was the big winner overall, The Pillars of the Earth, and Too Big to Fail. I don't believe any of those are from a major network. And Downton Abbey has already been renewed for a second season. When a show's renewed for a second season, how can you be a miniseries?
Well, good point. But, you know, the networks have not done miniseries in quite some time.
Right, but that's silly. They should. Nonetheless, this is not a miniseries. When a show's been renewed for a second season, sometimes a miniseries does have a sequel, but Downton Abbey was always conceived as a series. It didn't run for 20 episodes, but, you know, they made their episodes. They've already renewed it for a second season. It's going to run for 5 or 6 years. That's not a miniseries. Is Cloris Leachman a guest actor on the sitcom Raising Hope? One of the best nominations I thought was Martha Plimpton for Best Actress for Raising Hope.
Yes.
A very funny sitcom. I know you like it too. But Cloris Leachman was nominated as guest actor. She's on the show every week.
Yeah, but you know, the way they credit them in the billing, that actually counts not only...
It's the decision of the Emmys about who they want to nominate in what category. You can ask, you can say, I should be this or that, but that's not contractually binding. They can decide to do whatever they want. If you may say I'm a supporting actor like Elizabeth Moss did in in Mad Men for a few years, and then they don't nominate you because they know you're a lead actress. And now she finally got a nomination as a lead actress in Mad Men. You know, it's the Emmy voters that decide what you get nominated for, just like the Oscars.
Well, no, you have to submit yourself in a specific category. You can't just, I mean, the Emmys will not.
But then
there.
They reject you.
Well, right.
They say you're not a, you know, you can put yourself in a supporting actor when you're the lead, but they're not going to nominate you. They're going to say, no, Hugh Laurie is not a supporting actor in House. So that's why you don't get nominations, because you put yourself
in the
wrong category.
I mean, you could say John Cryer is a co-star of Two and a Half Men. He is one of the two men. So why is he a supporting actor? But yet he does better in the supporting actor category than he would in, you know, supporting actor in a comedy series than he would as a lead actor in a comedy series. So that's why he keeps submitting himself in that category.
Well, you know, every show is a different case, but I think it's true that if you put yourself in a category you don't belong into, you're hurting your chances. And I don't think, and I think people think of Two and a Half Men as Charlie Sheen's show, and that John Cryer was a second banana to him. And so supporting actor felt like a reasonable fit.
No Lea Michele from Glee. She did not get any nominations.
That yeah, the cast of Glee really does not get a lot of love. You see Chris Colfer got nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a comedy series again, and that's terrific. He's very good in the show. But, you know, and of course, supporting actress in a comedy is Jane Lynch as Sue Sylvester.
Yeah.
Other than that, they're really not represented, as opposed to Modern Family, where like, the entire cast seems to be nominated.
Well, probably the most kind of egregious, not egregious snub, but most outspoken omission was Sons of Anarchy, because Kurt Sutter, the showrunner and I guess creator of that series,
yes,
and his wife stars in it. His wife is Katie Sagal, and she wasn't nominated either. He's kind of outspoken. He has a great blog, and he took to Twitter. He was none too pleased.
Well, it's nice. He wasn't speaking about being dissed himself, but about the work of his wife, who is definitely giving one of the best dramatic performances on television, according to a lot of critics. Sons of Anarchy is another show that has been on for 3 years and that many critics think should be nominated for Best Drama, and it was overlooked yet again. But I think what really astonishes people is that Katie Sagal, in a very flashy, fun performance that is the sort of meat that Emmy voters love to dig into, did not get nominated.
Well, we're going to have to move on here because we have other news to cover, but in doing so, I would like to point out, going back to Kurt Sutter's tweets, I loved his tweet about, he says, me, David Simon, who is the creator of, and showrunner of, is it Treme?
Treme.
Treme, and Frank Darabont from of The Walking Dead, are meeting at Home Depot to rent chainsaws and wood chippers. He sent that off right after the Emmy nominations were announced.
That's very funny. The wood chip, of course, is a reference to Fargo. The Coen Brothers movie. That's very funny. But, you know, everybody always grouses every year about the Emmys. I certainly do. There were a fair number of fresh faces in a lot of categories. Everybody can pore over them online, and we'll all look forward to the Emmy Awards so we can bitch about that in a few months.
Well, but the big takeaway here from the Emmy nominations this year is that cable is a much bigger player in the television space this year, and actually, last year, it's basically growing. Cable's influence is growing, and that Conan O'Brien, when he said that anybody who believes that going from a network broadcast to a cable broadcast for a late-night show is a step down has not been paying attention to the television industry in the past couple of years. He was right.
It was a step down in ratings, however, for him.
Well,
but yeah, if you look in his category in particular, late night talk variety shows, only one came from a major Saturday Night Live as well, but all the late night talk shows, Letterman, Leno, Craig Ferguson, all ignored. The only one who got a nomination was Jimmy Fallon. All the rest were Conan and The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert and all that. So you're right. I mean, they're not a player there. They're becoming less of a player in reality. Their last bastion is sitcoms. It's amazing.
Well, speaking of Saturday Night Live, funny you should mention that, because Saturday Night Live plays into our next story, which is about Netflix.
Those bastards!
Well, they lowered their prices. Wait. I think they raised their prices. Well, okay, actually, it depends. There was a huge outcry this past week when Netflix, which was charging $10 a month for unlimited streaming and the ability to rent one DVD at a time, but unlimited numbers of DVDs in a given month, provided that you only had one out at a time. Now Netflix is forcing you, of course, to choose, do you want to stream movies for $8 a month, and their library is small but kind of fluctuating and growing for the most part, or do you want to rent unlimited DVDs one at a time for $8 a month? Or would you like to do both for $16? And if you want to keep all your current options, your monthly fee just went from $10 to $16, which is a 60% price increase. And if you almost never streamed or almost never rented a DVD, then the price just went down by $2 a month. And if you follow that, then good luck.
Well, it's not that complicated. They have two services. They have streaming of video, which is bigger and bigger to them, and they're going to expand overseas and worldwide just offering streaming video. And they're spending a lot of money on their library to build that up. They also, of course, ship you DVDs one at a time or two at a time or three at a time, depending on your plan, that you can have unlimited DVDs per week or month with a certain number at a time. They switched when they started to develop their streaming. They just sort of said, okay, we were charging you $8 a month to get DVDs if you just do one at a time. Now we're going to charge you $10 a month and give you all this unlimited streaming. And right. Now they realize it doesn't make sense that the DVD thing is just a $2 a month add-on. Doesn't make financial sense. There tend to be different groups of people doing this. The friends I spoke to were angry about the price increase, but when they looked at their pattern and their purchases, some of them basically just streamed over the last year and others basically just got DVDs. So they don't like losing that option, but the fact is that basically they're streamers or they're DVD-ers, and in fact, their price lowered. And so, if you look at their pattern over the past few years, it used to be $10 a month to just rent one DVD at a time. Then it was $9 a month, and now it's $8 a month.
So I remember when it was $19.99 here in the – well, again, Netflix is only in the United States. It's a rent by mail, and overseas they have Love Film and others. You know, I remember $19.99 per month. This was in like 2000, 2001 when they first launched. And they would let you rent, I believe it was six or possibly four DVDs at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is my problem with Netflix, and I'm not saying what they did here was wrong. My problem with Netflix is their operating procedure, and follow me here. I had two friends. They both were very early adopters to Netflix. They both were on their first program. I think it was, let's just call it four DVDs at a time. They both had the same experience, which is that they were avid movie watchers. They would watch sometimes 10 movies a month. All of a sudden, the movies that they were in their queue that they were renting started showing up slower and slower. So new releases almost never showed up. They somehow got throttled. They would never get the new release when it first came out. Instead, they'd get it 6, 7, 8 months later.
Well, and this is an entirely different issue than what we're talking
about.
But
wait a second. This is about operating procedure and kind of the culture of the company. So slowly, they actually stopped getting DVDs at all, and they would call up and complain. And Netflix turned to both of them separately and said, you know, you're going to have to pay for those DVDs. You're in a high crime area. Now, one of them was in a building where the mailbox was secure. The other was not. They both canceled their subscriptions. 3 weeks later, they both get letters saying, oh, we really miss you. Why don't you come back? You can rent three DVDs at a time. 6 months later, there was an article in Wired Magazine about Netflix. It was kind of the introduction of Netflix. What did they learn? That four DVDs per month to any one user lost them money. So rather than just change it and say, guys, we know that you have four DVDs out at a time. We can't do that anymore. Can we bring it down to three?
All right. They bungled that. That's fine. They bungled how they transfer. They see their business pattern changing. They bungled the switch from four DVDs to three DVDs. They didn't factor in that 1% of customers that would cost them money. And they should have handled that better.
But
that,
I think the same thing is true here. I think what they're doing is they're trying to get there's something going
on. They changed their policy officially, and they're not trying to trick you and claim it's some other reason. They're saying, if you just want to get a DVD, it's going to cost you as lower than ever. If you just want streaming, it's lower than ever. If you want to combine the two, we're now going to charge you more because we find that more people are just doing one or the other. And if you're doing both, we need to charge you commensurately so that we make money. For example, they just re-signed a deal with Comcast, NBC Universal, I should say. A multi-year deal to stream a bunch of their library, you know, decades of TV shows and movies. They're streaming it online and making it available to users. They were paying reportedly around $25 million a year. Now they're paying reportedly $250 million a year.
And they get less.
Well, not. I don't know about less.
Well, they don't get Saturday Night Live the season that it airs. They get
that's the only thing that changed. Yes. The one big notable thing was that they were providing Saturday Night Live, and now SNL is not available. It's only available in past seasons. Now, if you want the current episode, you have to go to Hulu or iTunes to rent or buy it. But yes, that's true, that one particular show. Otherwise, as far as I know, they have as many, if not more than ever, available via NBC Universal. But their costs of buying that library increased tenfold.
Well, isn't that funny? You have Comcast, which owns NBC Universal. They also, what else do they own? An ISP. And they can't charge Netflix, which probably uses up a good portion of its bandwidth in the evenings during prime time. They can't charge them higher fees to stream
the
content.
Well, they want to.
They want to, but they can't. So how do they do it? They do it through another avenue. They say, oh, you want our content now? Well, that's going to cost you a fortune. This was specifically the worry that everybody had, and it's happening exactly the same way everybody predicted.
I don't think it has anything to do with them being an ISP. The value of streaming video is growing exponentially. Everybody's charging more, even people who don't own ISPs. I don't think this is a backdoor fee. I think this is the fee that they said, you know what? You were launching the streaming service. We didn't charge you much. Now we see it's a really big business. You're going to do it all over the world, and we need to make more money off it.
Yes, but you have a much stronger negotiating stance if you say, oh, and by the way, you want
that's true.
You
that's
want in
true.
Our door? Guess what? You know, right. Yeah. So if you don't own an ISP, you have a weaker negotiating stance. So yeah.
My whole point is that the terms of the service are changing. The way people use Netflix are changing. There are people who are probably primarily streamers,
right,
and they've just had their price lowered. There are probably other people, and Netflix said, you know what, we're going to have people for a long time who just want DVDs in the mail. Maybe older people or people who don't adapt as well, or streaming is a little complicated. They don't want to stare at their notebook in order to watch television, and it's too complicated for them to get it on their TV. So those people still want DVDs. They're saying that's a viable business for us long term. We want to keep that going. We're going to break that away basically from the streaming and make it a separate little business. It's going to be not as fancy, not as flashy, not as big, but it's going to be a worthwhile business for them over the next 10, 15 years.
Yes.
I think it makes sense.
Well, the price does make sense. If you rent 4 movies in a month, 4 DVDs, whether it's through Amazon or iTunes or wherever you get it, then you've made up the difference between, you know, you've made up the $8. Let's put it that way.
You mean the $8 you pay per month?
Right, exactly. To Netflix.
So that's $2 a movie.
Right, exactly. And you can't get that. It's very hard to get that on any of these, you know, DVD rental services, whether it be Blockbuster, you name it. It's hard to do pay-per-view at $2 a month. So it's a pretty good deal. The problem that I have with it is, again, what I was trying to relay in that story is that Netflix seems to have this culture of, we're going to do something, we're not going to be 100% honest about why we're doing it. When really, if they were just honest and said, yeah, we want you to stop renting DVDs, we think that they are going to go away, they cost us a ton of money, it's cheaper for us to stream, we want to force the studios to start streaming more content and give us more content, okay, great. They want to make their point instead to the studios, no, look, more people are streaming than renting our DVDs now. Well, yeah, because you priced it in some ludicrous way that pissed people off.
I don't understand that it's happening now. It seems like they're being very straightforward. They're saying, we're giving you more options. If you just want to stream, you do this. If you just want to rent DVDs, it's cheaper than it has been for the past 5 years. And if you want to do both, you're going to pay a premium of $6 a month to rent DVDs, and you'll make that back if you watch 3 movies in a month.
Right. What do you think most people are going to do?
I think people are going to look at their thing and say, you know what? I haven't rented a DVD in 6 months. Or they say, I never stream, and they're going to choose one or the other.
Most people are going to pick streaming.
Well, there you go. Then they've just had their price lowered. So why are you angry at them?
Well, because rather than say, look, we're trying to lower our overhead.
No. They've said, we're going to make it cheaper. If you just want to stream, we'll lower your price. What's wrong with that?
Well, they're also lowering the amount of content that you have because all of the Sony titles are no longer on Netflix.
They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to obtain content. I'm sure they'd love to have content from every single provider that they could.
Oh, absolutely.
This is not an example of them not wanting to provide content.
Right, and basically the studios are saying, look, if we're going to deliver through Netflix and not have consumers come directly to us, then we're going to charge a huge premium for that, which makes it almost unaffordable to Netflix because we want people to come directly to us. They don't have a service yet, but I guarantee you in another 2 years, I would not be surprised if every one of these studios has a service where you can go to them directly and rent these movies.
But you know what? They're idiots because nobody wants to say, I want a Universal movie and have to go to Universal to find out what movies they have available. Here's a good example. A DVD catalog company called Acorn just announced that they're going to start streaming online their library. They specialize in classic British television. Their library includes the classic series Upstairs, Downstairs, the Agatha Christie's Poirot, Foyle's War, miniseries like Brideshead Revisited, and on and on. They've got a nice library. I love their stuff. I love British television. They've got a lot of it. What they're going to do is charge you $25 a year, and then you can stream portions of their library online. And they've got this weird, complicated system of for like Upstairs, Downstairs. They'll have a season on available for streaming for 6 weeks, and then they'll do this next season, like season two, and then they'll put next season, season three on. So you won't be able to go on there and say, I want to watch this whole series and just do it in order. You got to wait for the rotation of the actual season to
start.
That
does not work. That does not work.
Right, of course it doesn't work. What also doesn't work is saying, I want to go to acornonline.com to stream a television show, and I'm going to pay them $25 a year for the pleasure. It's like, no, people want to go to one or two services like Hulu and Netflix or iTunes and have everything there. They do not want to go to HBO and Universal and Warner Brothers and Columbia and Acorn and all these different entities to try and figure out where their TV show is based. They go to their cable TV and they turn it on and they find the show they want. When they go to a streaming service, they do not want to have to go and remember, oh, that's a Paramount film. So anybody who thinks that Paramount is going to launch a streaming service and make a lot of money off it, they're fooling themselves. It's a terrible business model. Make a good deal with the companies that are in the business and make it work and profitable for everybody. If you want to try to compete on your own as well, fine. But if you want to try and squeeze out companies that are helping you make money via streaming, you're an idiot.
Yeah, it's the same in retail. There are some manufacturers, which is what the studios and content owners are. They are manufacturing content. They have their websites and you can buy directly from them. Much like Apple, you can buy directly from Apple. Or you can go to Best Buy and you can buy through that retailer. And you know what? The prices are exactly the same. Apple controls that specifically so that there aren't debates between which store you should buy at. Buy wherever you want. Just buy. Well, the same thing is going to have to happen here with content. The big takeaways are that even though the price of Netflix subscriptions has gone up if you want to continue having both streaming and DVD rentals, and down if you want to have just DVD or just streaming, that this conspiracy theories are it could hasten the demise of the DVD, which is what something Netflix said, that the DVD wouldn't last another 5 years, and they said that 2 years ago. So it could hasten the demise. The studios and networks, of course, want viewers to go to their own offerings, which they don't have yet. So those are the two conspiracy theories. The other takeaway is that they have to pay for content, and all of these content owners are coming at them with some big, hefty bills.
And cutting the cord just got a lot more expensive. You know, people all talk about cutting the cord, but they presumably want access to basically the same programming that they have now. So if you're going to get Hulu Plus, that's $8 a month. Netflix, if you do both of these things, is $16 a month.
None of them have sports. I mean,
right. If it's available, you could get Major League Baseball for $80 a year. And that's just one sport. And that's $7 a month if you do it for the whole year. HBO isn't available unless you're a subscriber, but it probably will be sometime in the future.
That's just one channel. Iffy proposition because that's, well, we'll see. But
right. But so you're talking about $31 a month. You have no American Idol, no Saturday Night Live. You don't get most sporting events. You don't get HBO and on and on and on and on. So cutting the cord is not easy.
You know how I can – there is one place where I can cut the cord though, I think.
Where's that?
I am throwing my radio away.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't.
You have a radio?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually was showing it to my kids. I said, you know, and if you turn the knob and this antenna, they didn't get it. They wanted to hear Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in the middle of July, don't ask me why, one more time. And they wanted to listen to it again and again and again. And they didn't understand why on the radio you can't just pick the song you want to hear.
That's hilarious.
Yes. They
were like, play it again? You're like, it's a radio.
Well, yes, exactly.
Why was the song playing on the radio in July?
It was, I don't know if it was some kid's
goofy stunt or something.
Yeah,
okay.
I have no idea.
So why are you able to throw away your radio?
Well, there's a couple of services out there, and one new service just launched last week. I think we've talked about them before. Maybe you've heard of them. Spotify, have you?
That's right.
Yes. Now, this is a music streaming service. They have between what they claim is like 15 million songs in their catalog. They cut deals with the four major record labels in the United States, in North America, and they have a couple of other labels as well. They really do have a ton of music, and you can subscribe to them either for free and you can listen to, I think for the rest of the year, it's unlimited amount of hours.
But it's typically 20 hours a month, something like that?
It's between 10 and 20 hours per month. At some point moving forward, it will be between 10 and 20 hours per month. You will also get ads if you are using the free service. And I can tell you, having used the free service, those ads are numerous. You will also, well, you can also subscribe for $5 a month. You can get rid of the ads and listen as long as you want, unlimited listening.
For $10 a month, you can put it on your cell phone as well.
Cell phone, and you get a higher audio quality.
Mm-hmm. So they finally launched after all this wait. So we'll have to see whether they actually prove to have a service that's distinctive enough that they can actually compete after so many other people have gotten the jump on them.
Right. And who are some of those people? Do you know?
There's Rhapsody.
There's Rhapsody. Now, the closest that I've come to finding is RDIO, R-D-I-O. So it's radio, but without the A. And MOG, M-O-G. And these services are almost identical in nature to what Spotify is. And it's amazing to me how Spotify has been able to capture the mindset of, and the market really, the attention of the market, when there have been these two services in the U.S. for at least a year, if not more, that do the exact same thing.
And they have deals with all major labels?
Yeah. I mean, I did a comparison. Song for song, track for track comparison. I went to NPR, looked up their albums, the top 100 albums of the year so far, and I found all of those albums from obscure bands. I found most of them on Spotify, most of them on RDIO and Moog, or Mog, however you pronounce it, a few less on both RDIO and Mog, but not much.
Well, I think it's a name brand, and it's just like, they have the track record in Europe, so people care what they do here. We'll have to see what happens. It's sort of like Google Plus. You know, Google launched their social media service as their umpteenth try at it, and they're like, oh, it's exclusive. Only a few people can try it out, and they have 10 million people already. That doesn't match the 750 million people on Facebook, but it would certainly give me pause if I was Facebook, and we'll have to see how they do over the next 6 months to a year in developing that and making that be robust.
Now, you're on Google Plus. I invited you.
That's right.
Now, we have Google Plus invites that we could give out. So if you want a Google Plus invite, you should email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We can invite you.
That's right.
We create a little circle. Speaking of which, I tried to get the CEO of Spotify on this week, and he apologized profusely that he was a little busy, apparently, I don't know, launching a company. He said, but instead, what if I gave you a few invites, and you could invite some people to use the service? Because the Spotify invite is impossible to get. However, we have, I don't know how many we have, but how should we offer these up, Michael?
Using Google Plus? No, let's use Facebook.
Okay, so what? If people go to Facebook and they join our Facebook page, if they like
us
on
Facebook. They like us or whatever it is, yeah.
We will keep a list of people who join us on Facebook and like us on Facebook over the next week.
Or we'll include the people who already are members, right?
Of course.
Yes, and then we'll just, pick a numbers out of a hat and we'll find people that way.
Yes, we could do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way to be random about it, I think.
Okay, so that's what we will do. We have at least, I think, 4 or 5 invitations, if not more, to give away to the free Spotify service. I have been using it over the past several days. I'm in love with it. I really like it. Have you used it? I know I sent you an invite, but have you had a chance to log on?
I jumped on briefly. I'm not very typical because I have so much music anyway. But it was interesting. It was easy to use. And all we'll ask is that the people, if we do invite you and you use Spotify, let us know what you think about it.
Yes, please do. I mean, I've had a good time watching over the past week as people on Facebook start logging into Spotify or opening their accounts, and I can start to see, like, Bob Boylan of NPR. I saw all of his playlists dating way, way back. Now, some of that music I can't play because it's in his iTunes. That's another thing that kind of annoys me with Spotify. When I plug my iPod in, it like wants to sync with my iPod.
Even though you can't use it.
No, I can.
No, you'd have to pay to stream, to use Spotify on your phone, wouldn't you?
Well, I'd have to pay to use their songs on my phone or my iPod, yes.
Right, so you can't use Spotify on your phone unless you pay the annual fee. Of the premium service of $10 a month.
Right. But I can use it in place of iTunes for the music that's on my computer.
If you're not going to pay the $10 a month service, why would you want Spotify on your phone? You can't use it.
I plugged my iPod, not phone, in.
Oh, iPod.
Yes, it's that thing that was created by Apple long before the iPhone.
But you can't use it on your iPod either.
That's right, but it sees all iPods that are connected to it as something that it can sync to, at least the tracks that you already own and have on your computer.
Why does it need to sync to tracks you already own on your computer? I thought they had access to everything.
It is trying to become an iTunes replacement.
So how does that work? Does that mean if they see that you own it on your computer, that they will allow you to play it without ads or unlimited? Even if you go over your monthly limit,
yes,
they'll let you play your own stuff via Spotify. But so they want you to launch Spotify rather than iTunes when you start up your music on your computer.
Bingo. Yes, I was waiting for you to get to that.
Yes. They don't want, well, because I mean, I didn't realize that they were going to access your library and say, okay, you can play all your own music, obviously.
Yeah.
So all your own music appears on Spotify?
Yes. Well, Okay. Yes, it does, actually. So all of Bob Boylan's playlists, there's like 20 songs in a playlist, and only three of them I can listen to because they're on Spotify. The others are in his iTunes library.
I see. So I wouldn't want them to post my playlist unless I gave them permission.
Yes, well, they do ask you permission.
Yeah, okay. All right, now I understand.
So all of this, big deal or big whoop, Michael? What do you think? I mean, do you know?
We'll know in 6 months.
You'll know in 6 months. Okay, well, then maybe we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and determine whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, apparently bookstores are cool again, if only for a moment. Fantasy author George R.R. Martin has a bigger fan base than ever, thanks to the HBO series A Game of Thrones, nominated for an Emmy, by the way. That meant anticipation for Volume 5 of his series was huge, and sales did not disappoint. The new book called A Dance with Dragons went on sale, and even though genre readers have been gravitating towards digital, and this book in particular is a doorstop at more than 1,000 pages, it actually sold more physical copies by a wide margin. 170,000 print copies versus 110,000 ebooks and 18,000 audiobooks. That seems to be the magic number for audiobooks, don't you know?
Yeah.
What's been really interesting is the physical digital split, said Scott Shannon, the publisher of digital content for the Random House Publishing Group. He told the New York Times, "These days, for a lot of our big titles, digital is outselling physical. That's not what we're seeing here." Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, even though this book sold more in print than digital. The fact that so many people are buying books, big bestsellers, as ebooks. I mean, this industry is completely transforming. And, you know, I felt like an idiot going to the store and buying the book in print. I'm carrying this book around. It's 1,000 pages. It's like a walking, talking advertisement for the Kindle. I swear it's so big and heavy. And it's $35 list price. I actually went to Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side to get it because I didn't get a free copy from the publisher. Don't ask me why. But I had to pay $25 for it, which is $6 more than I would have paid online. So I felt like an idiot not going to barnesandnoble.com and pre-ordering it. You know, it would have been delivered to my door for $19. Instead, I paid $25. And I really wish I had the digital version, which is $15. So I hate that I had to choose. I hate that I had to pay a premium. They're driving me away from the bookstore. They don't want me to walk into their store and buy a book. I feel like I was dating Barnes & Noble, and now they're not returning my calls. They're doing everything they can to drive me away.
I'm not even going to touch that whole dating thing with the 10-foot pole.
It's bizarre. I wish I paid $25. I should have the physical. I knew I'd want that book on my shelf. I read the first four volumes. But I also wish they had provided me with a digital version. When I paid the premium price to get a physical copy, throw in the digital version for free.
So let me ask you this. With Netflix, it costs money to ship and send a DVD, but way more than streaming you a movie. So why not lower the cost of streaming?
They did.
No, but it's the same price as the DVD only.
Because they have to spend a lot more money to buy the access to the content to stream rather than just buying a DVD in a store.
Ooh, good comeback.
Thank you.
Great comeback. Look, all of these new business models take time to work out. And in the meantime, I agree with you. I think they are pushing you away from the store and to...
It's unbelievable. I felt like an idiot. I paid more money to get something, you know, it's like, don't walk into our store. Go to our website. That's what Barnes & Noble is telling me. Do not come into our store. We don't want you here. Go online. That's what we want you to do. Whatever you're buying, hardcover, digital, audio, we don't care. Just leave us alone.
Well, that might explain why Borders is dead. An auction for the company is this Tuesday, and the only bid on the table is from liquidators. So Borders could be closed for good as early as Friday. Though how long it takes to wind down the stores, sell all of the merchandise, etc., is up in the air. Still, you might want to dig up that Borders gift card and use it pronto Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop at this stage, but it's very sad news.
He will be back. Arnold Schwarzenegger's hiatus from the comeback trail is over. The actor has committed to a Western called The Last Stand, in which he plays an aging sheriff, not sure how much to risk to defeat the bad guys. Schwarzenegger had put a brief hold on acting plans when his marital woes and cheating came out, or let's call them infidelities. Also, you know, fathering of the illegitimate child was also probably a bit of an issue. Now he's back on track filming the movie this year for a release in 2012. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. He hasn't been a big force in his last number of years as a movie star, except for the Terminator movies. But still, it's going to be big news when he comes back. Enough time will have passed. People won't care. They'll be willing to embrace him. Be interesting to see if this very smart man can have a third or fourth act in his career.
Now, speaking of smart men, this next story probably should not have been in Big Deal or Big Whoop, but we really don't have much to add to it because the story changes literally by the minute. In fact, while we've been recording, a News of the World whistleblower was found dead. Reporter Sean Hoare was the first person to allege that Andy Coulson was aware of phone hacking by his staff. Now, what are we talking about?
Did he commit suicide? What happened?
They don't know yet. They just found him dead. It's not suspicious yet. They are investigating.
Wow.
What we're talking about is Rupert Murdoch delaying his purchase of the BSky B satellite TV service due to the furor over News Corp's apparent and frequent and flagrant breaking of the law to get news stories. And they did this through News of the World, one of the most profitable newspapers in the world up until—
And not just them. The Times of London is accused of phone hacking which I find shocking.
Murdoch has already shut down the Sunday paper News of the World and is widely expected to expand the daily tabloid The Sun to a Sunday edition within months, if not weeks. Similarly, Murdoch, who controls 39% of BSky B, in 6 months, he can start the whole thing all over again, even though he says, I'm pulling out, I'm not going to do it. He can redo the whole thing starting in 6 months and try and get the other 61%. BSky B would immediately be the most profitable division in Murdoch's empire. That I did not know. That's according to the Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, I find that amazing.
Meanwhile, this even over the weekend, it didn't let up. Top official, Rebecca Brooks, so she's was a top News Corp official. She stepped down. Rupert and James Murdoch are testifying in front of Parliament, I guess tomorrow. Numerous people have been questioned by the police, and rumblings about a coup of the News Corp board has surfaced. Maybe Rupert might not make it through this. You know, he is the chairman, but he does have a board of directors. That was a long, quick hit here.
People are being arrested. People are in jail and getting out on bail. People are losing their jobs. People are testifying in front of Parliament. They've shut down one newspaper. It's just unbelievable. All hell has broken loose.
That's right. So is it a big deal? I mean, it is a big deal. Let's face it. I don't even have to ask the question, do I?
There's no question. It is a big deal. It continues to grow. They keep thinking it's going to go away, and it's not going away.
Now you say here CNN Piers Morgan, who's on every night at 9 o'clock prime time, he kind of took over for Larry King. He may be implicated in the phone hacking.
That's right. He was an editor at News of the World. He was like the youngest editor ever there. I think he was like 31 or 29 or something when he was editor there or of the Mirror. He was at the Mirror. He's at News of the World. He referenced phone hacking in one of his memoirs. The news item I saw was joking how CNN was reporting all the phone hacking scandal, but refused to report on the fact that Piers Morgan himself might be implicated. Nothing has come of it yet. He hasn't been questioned by police, but that could prove ugly for them as well.
Oprah Winfrey is in charge of her own cable channel now. Winfrey decided to make it personal. She's taken the title of CEO and Chief Creative Officer at OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. She's not going anywhere, and she plans to make it work. Darn it, she's going to own it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I figured she would always get more involved once her TV show ended. She's probably a little upset that it's doing so poorly, but I never thought it would ever gain any traction until she started appearing on the channel herself, no matter how much money they spent on programming. Launching a new channel ain't easy. So I say it's a big whoop. I figured she would be, you know, the person in charge anyway once it got going.
Ted Danson has joined the cast of CSI, one of TV's most venerable and successful franchises, got a new lead actor this week. Lawrence Fishburne unexpectedly walked away after 2.5 seasons, and the show has announced Danson will be the new team leader, starting with the season premiere Wednesday, September 21st. Danson will continue to star in HBO's Bored to Death, and the Emmy winner's other TV credits include a recurring role on Damages, the sitcom Inc., and of course, Cheers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. CBS is in great shape, but this is still one of their premier franchises, and they want to send this show out on a strong note, replacing Lawrence Fishburne with Ted Danson. That's going to bring a lot of attention. So, you know, they realized even though CSI is very long in the tooth, it's still an important brand for them, and they want to keep it going.
More big news from TV show Glee, one of the biggest pop culture phenomenons of the last 3 years. It has spawned an extraordinary number of hit singles. We know they've hired a huge new writing staff, I think 6 new writers. We know they've named some new cast members, and now we know the biggest question of all. Will the stars of the show ever graduate from high school? And the answer is yes, they will, and the show won't be following them to college. Glee now hopes to become an American Idol type of show that keeps discovering talented young actors and singers and launches them into the world. Yes, Lea Michele, Corey Monteith, and Chris Colfer will graduate at the end of the 3rd season and then be gone, says creator Ryan Murphy. Many shows replace one lead actor, but how many replace all of their main stars? And after just 3 seasons, big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. I think it's the only way the show could work creatively long term. Anything else would have been a stretch. But it's still a bold choice. They may not be nominated for Emmys, but they are the heart of the show. And the only tacky thing about this was that apparently they found out about this decision via Twitter and online. You know, Ryan Murphy told this to people in news stories, and then that's how the cast found out. Like Chris Colfer said, he found out via Twitter. It's like, well, that's a big decision. You should have let them know. So I find that a little disappointing that he didn't pull them all together or call them on the phone and say, you know what, this season we've decided you're going to graduate. This is your last year. We love you, but this is the only way we can respect your characters and what you've created and keep the show vaguely realistic. You know, should have done that.
Yeah. Again, operational procedure. Hey, Michael, do you want to date a movie star?
I kind of do.
Then join the Marines.
One. I kind of want to be join the Marines. I'd like to date a Marine too. So it works perfect.
Well, maybe you can date them both at the same time. Just ask Dan Savage. One Marine serving in Afghanistan posted a YouTube video as a dare asking actress Mila Kunis to be his date to the Marine Corps ball, which, if you're in the Marine Corps, is a huge deal, the ball.
Yes.
Now, Justin Timberlake has agreed to go with another Marine to the same ball. This would be even more interesting if that Marine wasn't a girl. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. It's a cute little news story, but it's funny how they use social media like YouTube to make this happen. Otherwise, you know, he might have written her a letter and she might have sent him a photo with her signed signature. But because it was a YouTube video, it gained a lot of attention. News stories picked it up as a cute thing. And it's nice. It's nice of Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake to do it. God knows now this means all these movie stars are going to feel obliged to go to the Marine Corps ball year after year.
Yeah, I guess he was in Afghanistan, made this video, put it up and on a bed, and I guess Justin Timberlake said, oh, you should do it. You should do it during press interviews. So she, you know, she said yes.
She's like, well, now you're doing it.
Yeah, that's right. And then some, you know, smart, enterprising young woman in the Marines said, well, I'm going to ask Justin Timberlake. And he said, all right, let's go.
That's hilarious.
Barbara Streisand has been with Columbia Records for 50 years come 2012. And her 34th studio album, What Matters Most, will be released, I guess, next year.
No, I think it's this fall.
This fall? Wow.
Yeah.
She virtually always goes gold on every album, selling about 500,000 or more copies, no matter what. But in this day and age, what is Streisand and her catalog worth? She and Columbia are discussing that right now, with reports saying Streisand might want $20 million for a new album and 3 reissues. The area where she might be the most valuable, of course, is reissues. Is the idea that Streisand could leave her home of 49 years a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal symbolically. It just shows you how the major record labels just aren't in the game anymore. And also how major stars are not worth as much money anymore since they're not selling as many albums. Streisand has never been a huge bestseller. She's had a couple albums that have gone triple or 5 times platinum. But by and large, she's gone gold or platinum very consistently for decades. She's a big name for Columbia. She's one of the 5 Bs that they refer to inside the company, which include Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, Tony Bennett, and Barbara Streisand. They're sort of the cornerstone of a major record label, Columbia.
Not Burt Bacharach?
Burt Bacharach is an important artist, not a Columbia artist, I don't believe, but nowhere near the mainstay that they are. But he is a B.
Wait, not the Backstreet Boys?
Well, they were a big band, but no, they were not one of the 5 Bs, a group that's around for decades and decades and decades and proves just a huge catalog seller for a company. This used to be where you made your bread and butter. You developed an artist long term. You built up their career. Bob Dylan, never a huge platinum, you know, multi-platinum artist, never at all. But they were just a legacy group, and their catalog became more and more valuable as the years went on, and they were an important part of your company. Those days are basically dead, it seems like. And I don't know if Barbra Streisand is worth what she wants from Columbia. So this would be a sad end, but very indicative of where record labels are right now.
Well, before I have to think of any more musical artists whose names or group names begin with the letter B, we should move on from Big Deal or Big Whoop. Oh, B again. Huh. So I'm going to move us right along into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood or the entertainment industry might care about. Now, last week, after trying to explain all of this COICA and what the deal is with the ISPs and piracy, and stumbling over that in such a magnificent way, we're going to be talking to, as promised, Abigail Phillips, who is a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where she focuses on copyright and online content matters. Abigail, thank you for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
And Abigail, I just want to know, this is going to be a very tough interview because my attitude towards Electronic Frontier Foundation is I love everything that they do. I'm just a big
fan of the work
that they do and what they do for online privacy and, you know, for the rights of consumers and individuals in the EFF. So I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Well, actually, why don't we start there? What is the Electronic Frontier Foundation and what is it that the organization does?
Our mission is to protect your civil liberties online, the digital space. So we're really focused on the online world. EFF has been around since 1990. So we have a long history of being in this space.
People like me refer to the EFF as the ACLU of the internet.
Yes, some people say that, and I don't think that's completely far off. We focus on civil liberties, but then of course we also focus on intellectual property issues, which sort of expands our scope a little bit.
Right, and that's kind of where we came across a couple of posts that you have written lately. The latest is the content industry and ISPs announcing a common framework for copyright alerts. And what does it mean for users? Now, we tried to explain this on last week's episode, and we stumbled across whether it was COICA or Protect IP, or I don't even know what all of the other congressional acts are or federal acts are. But what's going on in Congress, and what have the ISPs agreed to with the content owners?
So the copyright alert system is a outside of Congress measure. It's a voluntary agreement that a handful of content owners agreed to with a handful of ISPs. So really, it's separate from anything legislative. It didn't have government representation, although I think it may have taken place in part at the behest of certain government agencies who are trying to encourage this kind of what they call voluntary measure. But really, the copyright alert system is just between those groups, so it doesn't affect any entities that aren't actually signatories to this particular agreement.
So, and one of those groups, those governmental groups, was rumored to have been the White House, kind of urging ISPs to start working with the MPAA and RIAA. Going back to Congress, what is COICA? What is Protect IP? Are there any other acts that are either in the works or were rumored to be in the works or discussed lately?
So Protect IP is like the next generation of COICA. COICA legislation came out last year, and then it didn't pass at the end of the year. So it got reintroduced this year, and it was reintroduced with this new acronym, Protect IP. We call it PIPA. I can't even recall what it actually stands for. It's quite similar to COICA, where it targets sites that are allegedly dedicated to infringing activity and would be a way for the government or private parties to go to court and get a website made unfindable, essentially. So what the bill would do is it would in different instances require a DNS provider to block access to the site. So if someone requests a particular domain that the domain doesn't resolve. And it would also have financial services providers and internet advertisers cut off their services to websites that are identified as dedicated to infringing activity. There's one other bill that's sort of interesting in this space. It's a bill about criminal streaming activity. What it would do is make online streaming punishable as a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor, which is the case currently under the criminal statutes.
So basically what we're talking about is piracy, as far as the industry is concerned. And we've had all these bits of legislation work their way through Congress. But recently what happened is that the content providers, like the represented by the RIAA, the recording industry and the movie industry and the TV industry, met with some of the major internet providers and said, hey, let's make a deal. They set up a structure where we're going to let you know when we think someone is being a pirate and we want you to warn them to stop. And we'll have this whole series of checks and balances to say, all right, we'll give you one warning, two warnings, three warnings, four warnings, and so on. And if they won't stop, you know, we want you to sort of slow down their service or do this and that. We're not asking you to kick them off the internet. We just want you to try and, you know, target these pirates when we identify them and make them stop if you can at all. So what's wrong?
I guess Michael just got cut off, but he was asking, what's wrong with that?
If this is purely about alerts, maybe that's not so terrible. But I think what's of concern to me is that this seems like it's leading to a place where users do get dropped from their internet service. There's a bit of a subtext in this agreement, which is represented by references to the DMCA. So the DMCA has a bunch of what they call safe harbor provisions that protect service providers from liability for copyright claims. And there are different groups that get this protection under the DMCA. One of those
And we should say that the DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was established in 1998.
Right. Thank you for that. Right. And so one of the groups that gets protection under the DMCA is ISPs, like the ISPs that are a party to this agreement.
So these service providers like Comcast or Earthlink or AOL or, I mean, you name
right,
it.
Right, or Verizon or AT&T and the Time Warner Cable.
Right, right.
I think they're all part of this agreement. There are several suggestions in the agreement that while the agreement doesn't require an ISP to take a user offline or terminate their service if they get a certain number of warnings, there's a suggestion that the ISP might not have DMCA protection any longer if they don't terminate the user. Now, what that says to me, and I think that's incorrect, but what that says to me is that that's what these content providers believe. And it suggests to me that they are trying to strong arm the ISPs into taking actions such as terminating users.
In effect, if they're warned that someone is a pirate and they don't take action to remove them, then they can become liable for all the damages done by that piracy.
Well, that's not necessarily true, but that's what the content industry would like to think.
Right.
And that's what that's potentially the argument that they might make.
Right. Well, I guess the issue here is that the ISPs, well, first of all, one of the ISPs is now a content owner themselves, and that's Comcast, which, talk about a conflict of interest, that's a whole other issue. But
yeah, an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, it goes right back to Netflix as well, but that's, again, another story. I guess the big controversy here is that the content owners would like the ISPs to not be just dumb pipes, but also be the police officers.
Exactly.
The other problem here is that when someone is accused of being a pirate, they have no real chance to defend themselves. The content provider says they're a pirate. The ISP gives them warnings. And unless you pay money and give up personal information and go through a huge lengthy review process, you could be disconnected from the internet, even though you've never been found guilty of a crime.
Yeah, that's exactly right, too. I mean, it's a funny process that's been set up. I mean, and it's the way it the way at least the agreement plays. A user gets a couple of warnings. They have to get just one warning, and then they get another warning that they have to acknowledge that they've received. Eventually, the future warning will say, we're about to take a particular mitigation measure against your account, which, like you were saying earlier, might be slowing down the speed or forcing someone to take some little quiz, maybe, like try to learn something about copyright. It's unclear exactly what all those measures are going to look like. And at that point, if the user wants to try to argue against it, then, like you said, then they can pay a fee to have their case reviewed. And then they have to present a whole argument as to why they don't think they were appropriately targeted.
So you're guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah, more or less.
But yeah, it almost seems like extortion. Like, you know, we could just start blaming everybody of infringement numerous times until they all pay us $35.
Well, you get your money back if there's a determination that you were wrongly targeted. But then, you know, that actually raises another question, which is, who's doing these reviews? And in theory, there's an independent reviewer, that's the term that the agreement uses, who's appointed to do a review. But we don't know who the independent reviewers are, and we don't know, you know, what their biases are going to be. And a lot of people are biased in one way or another in this space. And
a lot of listeners have sent us emails asking, how do the content owners know that I am illegally pirating software or content, or I am streaming an illegal video, or I'm using BitTorrent? How do they know that? There are certain organizations and companies that specialize in this, aren't there?
Yeah, well, so my understanding is that how this will work, and I mean, I don't know a lot of the sort of technical specifics, but this is content owners or whatever services that they're using on P2P networks watching the traffic. And so watching the IP, like if a particular piece of content that they identify as infringing comes from a particular IP address, then they'll grab that IP address and go back to the ISP and say, here's the IP address. You need to send a warning to this user. This is the content that's infringing. And then it's up to the user to say or not say, no, I never sent that, or I did, but I had permission to, or yeah, that was part of a mashup and it's fair use, or you know, whatever the response might be.
Piracy is an issue. Has the EFF developed any suggestions for how they think content providers and ISPs should tackle this problem that in a way that would be fair and respect the rights of people online?
Well, you know, I think the law already provides for quite a number of enforcement tools and tools for content owners. I mean, one thing we always think is a good idea is to look for new business models, new ways of making content more available to users so that they have good alternatives to unlawful channels, for example.
But you say they've got, if they see someone who's stealing, you know, 5 terabytes of movies a month, they can identify them, track them down, and have them arrested. So why do they need all these new tools? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, there are civil provisions in the copyright law, there are criminal provisions as well, as you've just said. Those seem to be adequate, and there isn't evidence that continuing to pass new kinds of enforcement measures is necessarily going to make the dent that the content owners are looking for.
Well, we all agree piracy is a multi-billion-dollar problem.
Well, it's a problem. How big a problem it is remains, you know, is always up for debate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of numbers that get floated out there, and it's hard to, I think it's hard to know how to interpret those. I mean, we can say yes, the content industry will put out numbers saying it's a multi-million dollar problem. But there are also lots of numbers suggesting that the content industry is doing very well. And there are other numbers that suggest that look at enforcement measures and suggest that, you know, maybe the best way to tackle these problems is not to just try to come up with more ways to attack infringers, but rather come up with better ways to compete with free, so to speak.
Well, certainly these are the growing pains of emerging technologies and emerging industries, but I think I speak for Michael here in saying I thank you for joining us not only today, but also for keeping up the good fight over there at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's an interesting issue. I think there's a big difference, of course, between pirates who actively and aggressively steal, tons of movies and sell them elsewhere, and individuals who take movies. But individuals who take movies are a problem. I'm not quite sure how you target some guy who just, never pays to see a Go movie. They just download them on the internet. It seems hard to track all those people down and hold them accountable. But, there should be some method in place to try and prevent that.
Well, I could have talked to Abigail Phillips all day because, of course, I'm fascinated by this subject. I agree with you. What if they're stealing music, though, not movies? Still the same thing.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I just figured,
Or books. Or books or TV shows or whatever.
I think books are the next big thing. I think books are the next big thing. Software, movies, and music are already pretty heavily pirated. But I think books, now that everybody's got one of these e-readers, I think you're going to see a lot more BitTorrenting of books.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
But, you could BitTorrent our podcast if you wanted. We don't mind.
Really?
Pirate.
We're free.
We're free. You don't have to pay for us. In fact, you don't even have to compete with us. We're free. You don't have to compete. We don't have to compete with free. We are free. So do us a favor. Go to iTunes. Subscribe to the podcast. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Subscribe in your RSS reader. Let your friends know about us. Try to support us in any way you can. In fact, if you go to showbizsandbox.com, you will find links to all those ways to subscribe, as well as ways to donate to the podcast, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and links to all of our past episodes. That's showbizsandbox.com. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Call us, leave us a voicemail. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. I wonder if they can be found on Spotify. I will have to check. I wouldn't be shocked if they could be. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. We can be found on Facebook. Again, if you want an invitation to Spotify or a chance to win an invitation to Spotify, like us on Facebook. And between now and next week's episode, we will pick a number of winners, 4 or 5 winners that we will send invites to. Like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. On Twitter, we are twitter.com/showbizsandbox. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.